This talk comes from www.euroleadershipresources.org. The European Leadership Forum is a bridge between local Christian leaders' needs and God's global resources. Hundreds of hours of key Christian thinking. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org and sign up to receive details of more resources that can support your ministry.
So, before the end of the session, we're going to hand out the overall plan for the 4 days to you, just so you can see the overview, including workshops. But I do want to make an announcement that Dr. Faxon's Wednesday workshop, if you're scheduled for that, it's been rescheduled for tomorrow. Tomorrow at lunchtime, right after the network, probably in this room. So if you're planning on going to that, you'll have a free time on Wednesday, or you can go to a different workshop, but you'll have to hear him tomorrow. Okay? Well, you have to if you want to. The time available for you to satisfy your desire is tomorrow. Okay. And we're very, very pleased to have Dr. Ross with us. He's giving quite a few different presentations and a post-forum seminar and one of the lectures at the university. So without further introduction, I'm going to let him give his lecture. Thank you very much.
Hey, very good. I'm the president of Reasons to Believe, and Reasons to Believe is an organization of research scientists that are developing new reasons to believe in a God of the Bible. And this talk will focus on the latest astronomical discoveries that are giving us significant new evidences for the God of the Bible. I started studying astronomy when I was 7. The first book I read on cosmology was when I was 7 years of age. And it was a book written by Fred Hoyle. And in that book, he talked about cosmology, the origin of the universe, in the context of different religions in his introductory chapters. And one of the things he said in that book was that the Bible, of all the holy books, was the one that had the most to say about cosmology, and what it had to say was truly amazing. And then he kind of dropped it. Well, years later, I began to look into what he had said. And he basically made 3 comments about what the Bible does say about cosmology, and then he let it go. He made the comment that the Bible is unique, and it actually talks about a beginning out of nothing. It talks about the universe continually expanding in a universe that gets colder and colder as it gets older and older. And he recognized that this was the elements of the Big Bang, and he was opposed to the Christian faith. In fact, what he talked about in that book is just how miserable of an experience he had in the Anglican Church. And I think that was the beginning of his opposition to the Big Bang model. But he did note that these were 3 features that the Bible talked about with respect to cosmology, and these features were unique amongst the world's holy books. Well, most of you are probably well aware of all the Bible verses that talk about this beginning out of nothing, what a physicist would call the cosmic singularity beginning. After all, you've got the 3 statements in Genesis 1, 1, 2, 3, and 2, 4. They're all the same. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The word heavens and earth in the Hebrew is a compound noun that means the entire physical universe. And the word create is to create brand new, something that did not exist before. And we see this theme picked up in the verses in Isaiah and Psalms. John 1 and Colossians 1 speak about how the Creator created everything that exists. Hebrews 11:3, the universe that we can detect was made from that which we cannot detect. Well, what's unique to our time is that we actually have hard scientific evidence that this biblical statement about the universe being created out of nothing, and literally beyond space and time itself. Paul in 2 Thessalonians and Titus speaks about how, pardon me, 2 Timothy and Titus speaks about how God created the universe before time existed, before space existed, that the creation of the universe was not only the creation of matter and energy, but space and time itself. Well, in 1970, this paper was published the singularities of gravitational collapse in cosmology. This is the paper that won the Wolf Prize of Mathematics for Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose and launched those two scientists to instant fame. And it launched them to instant fame because of the significance of this mathematical theorem. What they did in this theorem was to begin with the assumption that the universe contains mass. And most people are persuaded that's correct. If you're a skeptic, we can get a bathroom scale here. But the second assumption was that the equations of general relativity reliably describe the dynamics of the universe. And what they were able to prove, based on those two assumptions, was that there must be an actual beginning to space and time. Hence, this is the first of the space-time theorems of general relativity. If general relativity is a reliable theory, then indeed there must be this beginning of space and time. But there's a corollary in this paper that's often missed by the physicists who study it, namely that there must be a causal agent that's responsible for bringing into existence space and time independent of space and time. Now, Stephen Hawking was interviewed by the Reader's Digest shortly after this paper was published, and he boasted in that interview that he and Roger had proven that time has a beginning, that time was created. Now, the significance of that statement philosophically is if you were to go into the Eastern religions, we have God or gods or cosmic forces creating within space and time. The Bible is unique in making the statement that God creates independent of space and time. Now, Muslims will claim that that's in their book too, but it's in their book because they plagiarized the verse from the Old Testament. It's not unique to their book. Likewise, you'll see it in the Mormon scriptures. But once again, just like with the Muslims, they plagiarize about 25,000 to 26,000 words from the Old and New Testament. And so this really is a unique biblical statement, unique to other holy books, this concept that there's a creator that creates independent of space and time. Now, I was a graduate student in radio astronomy when this paper was published. And at that time, there wasn't complete confidence amongst astronomers that this theorem indeed was correct. And the reason for that lack of confidence is that we had only been able to demonstrate the reliability of general relativity to two places the decimal. Back in the 60s and 70s, it was exceedingly difficult to develop experiments, observations, that could test the theory of general relativity. So 1% precision was the best that we had. And when I was doing my postdoctoral studies at Caltech, there was a young astronomer there by the name of Erwin Shapiro that for the first time was able to prove the reliability of general relativity to a tenth of a percent precision, to three places of the decimal. But what has happened in the 1980s and 1990s is that there has been this long study of a particular binary neutron star. And what's unique to the 21st century is that we now have three close binary neutron stars that we can study, and one of them is actually a dual pulsar, where we got pulsation radiation coming up from both of the neutron stars. And, you know, with two neutron stars closely orbiting one another, you have gravitational forces that are about a million times stronger than anything we can observe elsewhere in our solar system or our galaxy. And the strength of the gravitational field enables you to make a more definitive test of the theory of general relativity. And when I put out this book, The Creator and the Cosmos, a couple of years ago, it was based on that one binary neutron star. And based on that one binary neutron star, we could prove the reliability of general relativity to 14 places of the decimal. Now, what is new in the 21st century, now that we have three binary neutron stars, and especially because one of them is a binary pulsar, we can now demonstrate the reliability of general relativity to 15 places of the decimal. And back in 1970, we had only four tests of the theory of general relativity, four independent tests. Today, there's over a dozen independent tests that we can perform on the theory of general relativity. In the words of Roger Penrose, general relativity is the most exhaustively tested principle in all of physics, and it's the best proven principle in all of physics. We are justified in having much greater confidence in the reliability of general relativity than we do, say, Newton's laws of motion. That being the case, there's really no basis for doubting the conclusions from this space-time theorem of general relativity. Now, this is the first of the space-time theorems. You know, one criticism that's been given about the theological implications of this paper is that this was only done in the context of classical general relativity. What was missing was the extension of this theorem to cover all possible quantum gravity models. But that has been done in the past 10 years, primarily in physics letters B. There's been a series of space-time theorems that have been published that are covering all possible quantum gravity situations where you're looking at the creation of the universe in its very early history where quantum effects become equally significant to the gravity effects. And it is such today that we can confidently state that the space-time theorems of general relativity apply to all reasonable cosmic models. So just to summarize, here we go. If the universe contains mass, and if general relativity reliably describes cosmic dynamics, then space and time must be created by a causal agent transcending space and time. And we live in a day and an age where the strength and the numbers of general relativity proofs are growing. In fact, in the year 2005, I would anticipate that another independent test of general relativity will be forthcoming, what's called the lens-Thuring effect, which up till now has only been able to prove general relativity to 10% precision, but thanks to the generosity of the U.S. taxpayer and a very expensive satellite, we should be able to extend that to four places of the decimal, and that will be one more proof that we have of the theory of general relativity. And so the theorems are becoming more generally applicable. And the words of Ford and Roman, this was published in Physical Letters, that all reasonable cosmic models are subject to the relentless grip of the space-time theorems. It was actually a research paper they published to look at what they call unreasonable cosmic models. And with those unreasonable models, you can get around this cosmic singularity beginning. But the only models that would allow that to escape from the space-time theorems were models that would violate the second law of thermodynamics, models that actually invoke negative energies. And we realize that those are unreasonable models because if we invoke negative energies in anti-thermodynamics, then we're looking at a universe that is simply an illusion, not real. In fact, one of the requirements for astronomers to exist in the universe is that the second law of thermodynamics pervade the entirety of the universe, all of its space and all of its time. Hence the comment from Ford and Roman that all reasonable cosmic models, the only ones that could possibly fit reality, are subject to this relentless grip of the space-time theorems of general relativity. So if you came this morning wanting rigorous mathematical proof that the God of the Bible is the creator of the universe, you got it right here. I mean, the space-time theorems by themselves are sufficient to establish we're looking at the God of the Bible. Why? Because only the God of the Bible, amongst the gods of the religions of the world, creates the universe independent of space and time. Now, one of the things we do at Reasons to Believe is that before we go out and present our messages to the public, we test it in front of unbelieving scholars. And so you might be interested, just how does this go down with an audience that's exclusively made up of astronomers and physicists? Well, they have a rebuttal, but it's only one rebuttal I've ever heard when I speak in front of such audiences, and this is the rebuttal. They'll say, if God created the universe, who created God? It's the same rebuttal I got from my sons when they were 3 and 4 years of age. Seems like everybody wants to know this. But the irony of this rebuttal coming from an audience of astronomers and physicists is that this space-time theorem of general relativity actually answers the rebuttal. Now, I would argue that the Apostle Paul gave a very adequate answer 2,000 years ago. But I found when you're speaking to a technical audience, sometimes it helps to give them the stuff straight from their own research. And what you notice in this paper is it's telling us that we have time being created independent of time. There's a causal agent that's responsible for bringing into existence time. Now, the significance there is if you were to go through all of the sciences and ask these science practitioners, what is the most general and widely applicable working definition of time that works in all the sciences, it would probably be this definition. Time is that dimension or realm in which cause and effect phenomena occur, where effects follow the causes. I mean, that works in every scientific discipline. That being the case, notice what this paper is telling us. We have cause and effect taking place before cosmic time even exists, which means that for the creator of the universe, that creator must have access to operate within at least the equivalent of two independent dimensions of time. And if we're talking two independent dimensions of time, then we can conceive of time as a plane rather than as a line. Now, if we're talking about a plane of time, it would be like this sheet of paper, and notice that you can have as many timelines as you want in as many different directions as you please. Therefore, it would be possible to conceive of God operating on a timeline over here that's infinitely long, that never crosses or touches the timeline of the universe over here. As such, that God would have no beginning, no ending, and would be uncreated. Now, something else you'd notice when you compare the different holy books of the religions of the world, the Bible is the only holy book that says of the Creator, He is no beginning, He is no ending, and He is uncreated. Mathematically, that statement would only be correct for a being that would have access to at least the equivalent of two independent dimensions of time. The Bible is also the only holy book that makes the comment that God can arbitrarily compress time in our context or expand time. I mean, you've got Psalm 90. A day of the Lord is like 1,000 years. 1,000 years is like a day. 1,000 years is like a watch in the night. Well, a watch is only 3 or 4 hours. So clearly Psalm 90 is making the claim that God can make time as small as He wishes in our context or as long as He wishes in our context. And I've got some diagrams in my book, Beyond the Cosmos, where I demonstrate that that's only possible, again, for a being that has access to at least the equivalent of two dimensions of time. So in this context, only the Christian perspective really provides a satisfactory answer to the question, who created God? Namely, that the cosmic creator operates in the equivalent of two or more time dimensions. Incidentally, I'm not saying that God does this through extra time dimensions. I'm just saying this is the minimum by which you can pull this off. As I mentioned in Beyond the Cosmos, we're looking at a God that can create space-time dimensions of will and perhaps other dimensions as well. He is in no way confined by the dimensions that He creates. Now, one of the things we're trying to respond to at Reasons to Believe is a common complaint on the campus that when Christians come up with creation models, they're not testable, they're not falsifiable, and they're not predictive. And so we're quite aggressive in making predictions about what scientists will discover if we're correct about the God of the Bible being the creator. And just based on this one subject alone, we would make the following 6 predictions. That as astronomers learn more and more about the universe, that we would expect that the evidence for a single cosmic beginning will multiply, or that evidence against multiple beginnings will decrease, that evidence for finite time as opposed to infinite time will grow, that the evidence for general relativity reliably describing cosmic dynamics will increase. In fact, we would argue that even in the next 12 months, we're going to see this evidence significantly increase, and that the grip of the space-time theorems will become even more relentless than they are today, that the case for a transcendent causal agent will get stronger and stronger, and that we would expect that evidence for other miraculous acts will be found. And the point is this. What we have in the space-time theorems of general relativity is an undeniable miracle, arguably the biggest miracle we can imagine, the coming into existence of all of physical reality. That being the case, that forces open the door that there might be other miraculous interventions by this transcendent creator. And so this is a great way to open up the door for intelligent design discussion. Here is a miracle that no one can deny. That being the case, we can no longer look at science as a discipline that's miracle-free. We have incontrovertible evidence for at least one. Therefore, we have to be open to the possibility that others may exist as well. Now, what is remarkable to me as I go through the Bible is that the Bible actually has much more to say about the expansion of the universe than it does the beginning of the universe. Here are just a few of the passages that we find in the Bible that talk about the stretching of the heavens. That's the typical English translation. The word that's being translated here is the word nata, and its best definition is one of continual expansion, but usually it's translated the stretching out of the heavens. And there are four things that these passages say about this cosmic stretching. Seven of these passages put the verb nata in what's called the cal participle form, which means that God on an ongoing, continual basis is expanding the universe. Three of these passages put it in the cal perfect form, which means that when God created the universe in the beginning, he created it with the physics that would guarantee ongoing, continual expansion. Two of these passages, notably Job 9:8, makes the comment that God alone expands the universe. In other words, Job is telling us that we should expect to find something supernatural about this cosmic expansion. And then we have in Psalm 104, verse 2, and Isaiah 42:5, the statement that God stretches out the heavens like one would stretch out a tent. And the metaphor here is taking a tent out of a backpack and stretching it out to make a home. And the metaphor's power is that the reality of a tent is its surface, not its interior or its exterior. Likewise, as we astronomers measure the universe, we recognize that the reality of the universe is its surface, not its interior or its exterior. Rather similar to what we see here on planet Earth. Planet Earth is a three-dimensional body, but we human beings live on the two-dimensional surface of a three-dimensional Earth. Likewise, astronomers now recognize that all the stars and galaxies, all the matter and energy, is distributed on the three-dimensional space surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe, ignoring for a moment the six tiny dimensions that accompany the four big dimensions. Now, what I'd like to explore is the statement that we see in Job 9:8, that God alone is responsible for this cosmic stretching. Let me just take you back to the days of Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein developed the equations of general relativity, which predicted this cosmic expansion. Now, the significance there is no scientist had ever even dreamed of the hypothesis of an expanding universe until 1916, when Einstein came up with his theory of general relativity. And yet we have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Zechariah, Job, we have King David, all speaking about this cosmic expansion thousands of years before the scientists had discovered it. And again, this is unique to the Bible. No other holy book, no book of philosophy, speaks of this cosmic expansion until the 20th century. So this is an example where the Bible, 2,500 years in advance, had predicted future scientific discoveries. Now, back when Albert Einstein came up with his theory of general relativity, astronomers quickly recognized that one of the influencers on the cosmic expansion would be gravity. And this is just straightforward junior high physics, namely that two massive bodies will tend to attract one another, and the closer they are together, the more powerfully they attract. And so a prediction that comes out of Big Bang cosmology and the theory of general relativity is that when the universe is young and therefore small, the pieces of matter are close together. And so gravity will act as a powerful brake to slow down the cosmic expansion when the universe is young. But as the universe gets older and older, the space surface gets bigger and bigger, and the mass of bodies get farther and farther apart, and gravity becomes progressively weaker and weaker in its capacity to slow down cosmic expansion. So, for example, when I was a graduate student, there was great anticipation as we look far away in the universe, and therefore back in time, we'll be able to observe how cosmic expansion in the past was slower and gradually speeds up as we come up to the present day. But in 1998, this paper was published by Lawrence Krauss, chairman of the Astronomy and Physics Department at Case Western Reserve University. And in 1998, he predicted that astronomers are on the verge of discovering a second factor that governs cosmic expansion. It's a term that we now refer to as dark energy, but back in 1998, it was called the cosmological constant. And this dark energy was an hypothesized property of the space surface of the universe. And the popular press has been called an anti-gravity term, but I prefer to call it an anti-elastic band effect. An elastic band has a property that the more you stretch it, the more energy it gains to force contraction. This dark energy, aka the cosmological constant, tells us that as you stretch the space surface of the universe, the more you stretch it, the more energy it gains to force more rapid expansion of the universe. And you get the opposite prediction that you would from gravity, namely that when the universe is young and therefore small, the surface will be small, and therefore there won't be much energy to expand the universe at a more rapid rate. And when the universe is young, we would expect gravity to be the dominant factor in cosmic expansion. But as the universe gets older and older, that space surface stretches and therefore gains more and more energy to thrust forward more rapid expansion of the universe. And we would expect as the universe gets old enough that there would be a transition from gravity being the dominant component to this dark energy being the dominant component. But in the second paragraph of this paper, we have Lawrence Krauss making the following statement. He says, dark energy would involve the most extreme fine-tuning problem known in physics. And he calls it a problem because his perspective is that of an atheist. As an atheist, he would see this as a huge problem. And let me explain why. What he points out in this paper is that the expansion of the universe critically determines what kinds of objects will form in cosmic history. If you expand the universe too rapidly, then gravity will never have the opportunity to collect the gas and the dust and make stars and galaxies and planets. That being the case, there'll be no location in which life can arise and life can exist. On the other hand, if you expand the universe too slowly, then gravity becomes so efficient that it collapses all the mass of the universe into black holes and neutron stars. And in black holes and neutron stars, you're looking at a minimum density of a billion tons per level teaspoonful, which is so dense that not even molecules or atoms can survive, and therefore life would be impossible. But what Lawrence Krauss points out in this paper, in order to get a star like the Sun and a planet like the Earth, so that life would be possible, not just life as we know it, but any kind of life would be possible, then you must tune the mass of the universe to within one part in a quadrillion, 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 one part in 10 to the 60th. And in order to have life exist, you must choose the value of the dark energy term to within one part in 10 to the 120th. Now that was 1999. Most astronomers would argue that the fine-tuning for dark energy is far more spectacular than one part in 10 to the 120th. Roger Penrose on the British Broadcasting Corporation made the claim that the fine-tuning exceeds one part in 10 to the 240th. Now, that's the basis of Lawrence Krauss' statement, that this is the most extreme fine-tuning problem known in physics. But as a Christian, I would put it this way. This is the most spectacular argument or evidence we have for supernatural design. There's nothing more spectacular in the sciences that we can measure. Perhaps there is, but in terms of what we can actually measure, this ranks as by far the most spectacular evidence we have for supernatural design. Now, so you say, why are you saying that it's supernatural design? Because we can compare that one part in 10 to the 120th with the very best example of human engineering design. And if you were to ask me, Hugh, what's the best example you can think of engineering design, I would say the gravity wave telescope that's up and running in the state of Kansas and Washington in the United States. This machine, designed by Caltech and MIT physicists and funded by the U.S. taxpayer, is so exquisitely engineered, it can make measurements to one part in 10 to the 23. So it's by far the best machine that we've ever been able to build. Yet, this best machine we've ever built ranks 10 to the 97 times inferior to the minimum level of design that we see in this dark energy term. So what does that tell us about this causal agent that transcends matter, energy, space, and time? It tells us that that causal agent, at a minimum, is 10 to the 97 times more intelligent and more knowledgeable than those Caltech and MIT physicists, and at least that many times better funded than those Caltech and MIT physicists. So no longer is it appropriate for astrophysicists to refer to this entity as a causal agent beyond space and time. That's how he is described in the scientific literature. Because of this discovery of dark energy, we need to start referring to him as a personal being, because only a personal being can manifest the properties of intellect, knowledge, creativity, and power. Now, we're talking a personal being that is able to fine-tune at a level that's 10 to the 97 times superior to what we can fine-tune. This also tells us we're dealing with an intimate and a caring creator. And so this can be used as another argument to distinguish the God of the Bible, say, from the God of Islam, the distant, disinterested God, or the gods of the Eastern religions. Now, a paper I saw posted on the Los Alamos website a couple years ago, also written by atheists, three atheists, two from Stanford University and one from MIT, Dyson, Kleban, and Susskind, well-known theoretical physicists. And the title of their paper was Disturbing Implications of a Cosmological Constant. And what they printed in their preprint is the following statements about what this dark energy would mean. They said, arranging the universe as we think it is arranged would have required a miracle. Rather remarkable statement coming from three atheists. But they went on to claim that an external agent, as a consequence of this dark energy, external to space and time, intervene in cosmic history for reasons of its own. Now, these three theoretical physicists, as atheists, found this so utterly disturbing that they wound up concluding in the last sentence of their paper. Let me find it here. Here we go. This is the last thing they said in their paper. That the idea of an external agent performing miracles for reasons of his own was so disturbing that, quote, the only reasonable conclusion is we do not live in a universe with a true cosmological constant. In other words, they said dark energy has got to be wrong. It can't be right. Because if it's right, we're stuck with this external agent performing miracles for reasons of its own. Now, the irony of the posting of this preprint is that it was only a few weeks later that we have the first two confirmations of dark energy to about two places of the decimal. When this paper was first put up on the Los Alamos website, the best astronomers could do is show that probably dark energy exists. But a few weeks after this paper was posted, it became not just probable, but definite. This is a short list of confirmations of dark energy, 9 independent observational confirmations that dark energy exists. And if you want to see the research papers, these are all posted up on our website. We have a feature on our website called Today's New Reason to Believe, where every day we post a brand new scientific discovery that gives more proof for the God of the Bible. And if you look at the past year's postings, you'll see these confirmations. Now, some of these came out as early as 2000 and the end of 2002, the beginning of 2003. But what you'll see on our website are the very latest measurements from galaxy cluster X-rays. The WMAP was probably the first public awareness that dark energy dominates the universe. It's the dominant component of the universe. The WMAP measured that dark energy made up 73% of the total stuff of the universe. But gravitational lenses now show us that it makes up 74%. Galaxy cluster X-rays, 72%. What we have here are a list of 9 confirmations independently made that tell us, each of them tell us, that dark energy not only exists, but it's the dominant component of the matter and energy that makes up the universe. And 4 of these measurements are able to measure dark energy to about 1% precision. And the values all agree. Therefore, there's no longer any basis for doubting that dark energy exists. Given that dark energy exists, we really are stuck with this external agent performing miracles for reasons of his own to a very exquisite degree. Now, what I've talked about so far are just 2 design features of the universe where we can make measurements and show that the design must be performed by an agent that's not only super intelligent, but supernatural. See, this is where we're now identifying who the designer is. It's not just some ill-defined intelligent designer. We're talking about a super intelligent, supernatural designer that transcends space and time, a supernatural designer where we can calculate to what degree he is capable of designing and how he designs and how that design is manifested. This is singling out Jesus Christ from the pack. And so I would argue that the intelligent design movement needs to move from simply arguing for some ill-defined intelligent designer and saying the scientific evidence is already more than adequate to establish that it's Jesus Christ rather than the gods of the opposing religions of the world. Now, we can draw this conclusion not just by looking at the mass density of the universe or the dark energy density. We can draw this conclusion from looking at a number of features of the universe. So what I have here is a short list of design features of the universe. The first 4 on the list refer to the 4 fundamental constants of physics. And all of these must be exquisitely fine-tuned for any kind of physical life to exist in the universe. For example, the ratio of the electromagnetic force relative to gravity must be tuned to within 1 part in 10 to the 40th, or you will not get stable burning stars. Stars will either not form at all, or they will instantly explode, unless we very carefully fine-tune the ratio of electromagnetism to gravity. And this already exceeds by far the best capabilities of human engineering design. And so this is a list of characteristics where we see fine-tuning that's exceeding the best that we human beings can perform. The age of the universe must be very exquisitely fine-tuned for intelligent life to exist. What's interesting is that the universe offers a fairly broad window for bacterial life, about 5 billion years wide, but an exceptionally narrow window for human life or anything like human life to exist. And I'll be speaking, I think, on Thursday on just how incredibly narrow that window is. We're talking humans living in a civilized state. There's a secular proof that demonstrates that it must be narrower than 41,000 years. But we believe that the window is actually narrower than 20,000 years. And when you contrast that with the age of the universe, it gives us another argument for this caring creator. But if you'd like to see the whole list of design features of the universe, on our website at reasons.org, we have a list of 74 cosmic design characteristics demonstrating superintelligent, supernatural design. And we'll also give you a list of all the research papers in which this evidence has been published, so you can see for yourself what kind of evidence we're looking at. Now, one of the things we're trying to demonstrate at Reasons to Believe is that the way to argue for this Jesus Christ, the God of the Bible, is to begin with the simple sciences and move to the complex sciences. So, for example, this afternoon I'm going to be talking about human origins, which I would argue is probably the most complex of the sciences. But we would say start with the mathematics, the astronomy, and the physics. And the whole principle here is when you're moving into the biological sciences, there the research experts have difficulty seeing design because they're looking at a subject matter that is so enormously complex. They can't see the forest because of their attention being focused on the trees. But if you can take them in baby steps from simplicity to complexity, and if you make those steps small enough, what they will see is as the complexity of the subject matter increases, the evidence for design increases. So I purposely started with the simple stuff, because when you're looking at the gross features of the universe and the physics of the universe, with great rigor, you can prove the design. But now I'd like to take you up one more step of complexity, where we look at what I would call the heavenly body problem, that life is not possible unless you live in a very special kind of galaxy, and life is not possible unless the planet is orbiting a very special kind of star, and you need four special kinds of gas giants orbiting that star along with the planet. And of course, the Earth has got to be just right, and the just right moon. Now, let me give you just some examples. I won't be explaining these. These are all explained in our book, The Creator and the Cosmos. And if you don't like to read, or you know people who don't like to read, this is a problem in the States. We run into all these people who, because of video games, have stopped reading. And so we produced a DVD that takes them through the same subject matter. And what we show you in the DVD is, first of all, it takes a galaxy that's medium large. Life is impossible in a giant galaxy. It's impossible in a medium-sized galaxy or dwarf galaxy. It must be medium large. If it's too big, then you generate these enormous black holes in the center of that galaxy, which would be toxic to life throughout that entire galaxy. But if it's too small, your galaxy will be distorted by the gravitational influences of nearby galaxies. The galaxy must be just the right type, a particular kind of spiral galaxy. It must have just the right neighbors. You basically want lots of dwarfs in the neighborhood, but no big galaxies in the neighborhood. You want the galaxies to be a certain distance apart. The intra-cluster galaxy cluster medium must be just right. And you'd want this little grouping of galaxies to be on the extreme outer fringe of a supercluster of galaxies, just like ours is. Then you narrow in on the solar system, and you discover that if you want life, you need this tremendous abundance of heavy elements, which means that your star must form adjacent to a type 1 supernova. Not too close, mind you. If it's too close, the supernova will blow apart the solar system. But if it's too far away, that solar system won't absorb adequate heavy elements. And it must be the just right time, too. If it's too early or too late in the formation of the solar system, and you will not get the adequate enrichment of the heavy elements. But it turns out that type 1 supernova only make about half the heavy elements we need. The other half are made in type 2 supernova, and this is a little bit out of date. What has been discovered, and you'll see this post on our website, they've now come up with what they call a category 3 supernova, a type 3 supernova, an extremely rare form. But it makes about 6 heavy elements that are necessary for the sustenance of advanced life. And therefore, we have to have the solar system form where we got these 3 different kinds of supernova all exploding at the same time at the same location relative to Earth. And then we also need I have the just right gamma ray bursts coming on the Earth. It turns out the gamma ray bursts are responsible for making two of the elements that are critical for advanced life. Well, I won't go into all the rest of the details here. You'll see this in our books and in our DVDs. And then with respect to planet Earth, it obviously must be the just right size, just right solar distance. And what is new is we now recognize that our planet would have been poisonous to life unless it received a collision from another planet about the mass of Mars. And this Mars-sized collider was responsible for preventing our planet from having an atmosphere that would have been far too dense for life. A just right moon. In fact, I think I've got a little clip here that we can show you. Let me see if I can get this to play. This is from our Journey Toward Creation DVD. Here we go.
Exploration enabled us to confirm that lunar rocks differ chemically from Earth rocks. Through study of lunar rocks' radioactive decay, researchers discovered that the moon is in fact nearly 100 million years younger than the Earth. In the 1990s, a theory explaining the moon's existence gained wide acceptance in the scientific community. According to this theory, an object the size of Mars crashed into the newly forming Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. Most of the object's mass was absorbed by the Earth, but this collision also sent up a huge cloud of dust and rocky fragments all around the Earth. In time, gravity pulled those fragments together into one solid body, the Moon. The Earth, meanwhile, lost its entire atmosphere, and a new, much thinner one began to form from gases released by Earth's crustal material. Such a collision may seem a disaster, but it proved just the opposite. It set in motion certain alterations to Earth's features that eventually made this planet a uniquely suitable site for life. The odds against a collision benefiting the eventual support of human life are staggering. The planet colliding with the Earth would need to be the right size, moving at the right velocity, striking at the right angle, made of the right materials, and occurring at the right time in the development of planet Earth. If any one of these factors were off by just a few percent, the Earth would be barren today. Unless that impact had occurred, Earth's atmosphere would be much heavier than it is, even heavier than that of our neighboring planet, Venus. Venus's thick carbon dioxide-filled atmosphere would mean instant death for all possible life. The extra mass Earth gained from the collision, along with its atmospheric revision, meant that water could exist on Earth in all three states: ice, liquid, and vapor.
Okay, that was updated about 14 months ago. And again, if you go to our website, you'll see that there have been several additional discoveries made that indicate that the level of design in this moon-forming event is even more spectacular than what we were able to show you in this DVD. In fact, what I have here is the latest publication. This is in the last issue of Astrobiology. And it's a British physicist who poses the question, how come the moon is so big? Now, the standard answer to that is, unless the moon is really gigantic, a gigantic moon orbiting a small planet, then the tilt of the rotation axis of planet Earth would become unstable like the other planets in our solar system. Ours is the one planet that has this stable tilt of the rotation axis, which is certainly critical for advanced life. But in his analysis of the Earth-Moon orbit, what he discovered is that you actually get the greatest stability if the moon were about half the mass of what we measure. And the moon's mass is actually at the very upper end of where you would get stability in the tilt of the rotation axis. In fact, if the moon was about 1.5% more massive than it is, then our tilt would become unstable. So the question he asks is, why is the moon at the very hairy edge in terms of its mass of driving the rotation axis tilt unstable? And what he was able to conclude was this, was that unless the moon was at the very upper limit of its mass, then the Earth's rotation rate would not have slowed down enough for advanced life to be possible on the planet. In this sense, that new research now shows us,
that this new research now shows us that, I lost my train of thought. Let me get it back again. We're talking about the moon. Yeah, I knew that part. right. Okay. Gotcha. New studies on this moon-forming event tells us that this Mars-sized body colliding with the primordial Earth would rapidly spin it up, so its rotation rate becomes about 2 hours a day, while advanced life requires a rotation rate of about 24 hours a day. In fact, if it's 23 or 25, we wouldn't be able to develop advanced civilization. And so it's necessary in the time permitted, because remember I made this comment earlier that there's this extremely narrow window of time in cosmic history in which human life is possible. You know, it's a good thing we live in a universe that's 13.7 billion years old. If it's any older or younger, then we human beings would not be able to exist. And so it's necessary that we slow down the rotation rate of the planet in about 4.5 billion years. And in order to slow it down that rapidly, you need a moon as massive as what it is, at the extreme upper limit of what you would require for it to have a stable rotation axis. So that's just one example how every day new discoveries are being made that are giving us more evidence for the supernatural design of the universe. And in fact, on our website, you'll see 4 years of calculations. And there's a reason why we have 4 years' worth. But this goes back to May of 2002. And at that time, our staff had accumulated from the scientific literature 202 different characteristics of our galaxy and solar system that demand fine-tuning for life to be possible. And the probability was one chance in 10 to the 265 that all that would be met. Now, the standard argument against that is, well, you haven't taken into account the dependency factors, and you haven't taken into account that the universe might have lots of planets. Well, we actually do, and it does reduce our probability down to about one chance in 10 to the 217. We use the most optimistic estimate for the number of planets in the universe, namely about 10 billion trillion, and we also use the most optimistic estimates for what the dependency factors are. But what I want to do is compare this calculation with what we came up with just 22 months after that. April of 2004, 322 characteristics, and now we're looking at a probability when you take into account the dependency factors and the maximum number of planets, less than one chance in 10 to the 282 that you're going to find a body anywhere in the universe with the capacity to support life without invoking divine miracles. Now, most of you are quite familiar with exponents like that, but let me give you a little tool to communicate that to lay people. Okay, how do you get a handle on what this number really means? Well, we can take the entire observable universe of 100 billion trillion stars, and of course the stars are extremely far apart, and we're going to fill that whole universe with dimes, where the dimes are packed as close together as they can be, so there's virtually no space between the dimes. If you were to do that, the universe would contain 10 to the 82 dimes. So the probability of finding a body somewhere in the universe with the capacity to support life, not just life as we know it, but any kind of physical life, without invoking divine miracles, is 10 to the 200 times more remote than the probability that blindfolded you could pick out a single marked dime from a pile of dimes that fill the entire observable universe with no space in between. Now this explains why we have Paul Davies, for example, making the statement in the Cosmic Blueprint, it seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers and the impression of design is overwhelming. In fact, I devote a whole chapter in this book to quotes from non-Christian astronomers who have done research in this discipline. And to a man and a woman, they agree with Paul Davies' assessment that the evidence for design is overwhelming. Now, in terms of trying to develop a testable hypothesis here, what we have done at Reasons to Believe is to say, okay, what if the atheists are right and we're wrong and we're simply being deceived by all this design evidence? Well, then you would make the following prediction, that as astronomers learn more about the universe, this evidence for supernatural design will decrease. In other words, we would expect the number of characteristics manifesting fine-tuning, instead of getting bigger and bigger, will get smaller and smaller. We'd also expect that the degree of fine-tuning would become less and less, and that the evidence that Christ is a designer will get progressively weaker as we learn more and more. But what if the atheists are wrong and we're right? Then we would expect the opposite, that divine design evidences will increase in strength and number, and that evidence for Christ as a designer will get progressively stronger. And that's why we post a new scientific discovery every day on our website. And by the way, you can get that as a downloadable email for free. So every day you can show one of your skeptical friends a new scientific discovery that gives them more evidence for the Christian faith. And when we speak about this on university campuses, we have atheist scientists oppose us and give a response to our evidence. But the way we try to make peace with them is to say, well, you know, there's no need for us to get into a big conflict over this. Let's wait 6 weeks, and in 6 weeks we'll see whether the evidence gets stronger for the Christian faith or it gets weaker. I mean, every day there's about 10 discoveries that are being made that we can throw at this problem. So literally within a day or two, we can see who's right and who's wrong. And let's, you know, get rid of the emotion and all the hostility, and let's just wait a few days. Now, what I want to share with you in the remaining time is what I would call the rebuttals that we get from the experts in the field to this argument. And what's interesting is these rebuttals are not scientific. They're philosophical. And that, by the way, is why we employ a full-time philosopher on our staff. What we scientists at Reasons to Believe say to our staff philosopher is that your only value to us is to help us win arguments against other philosophers. But it's worth paying them a good salary to help them, help us win those arguments. But the first rebuttal, and again, I've only heard three, but rebuttal number one, and this comes predominantly from Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking. They would admit, like Paul Davies, that when we look at the universe, we see this overwhelming evidence for design. But they say the designer can't be Jesus Christ. And the reason for arguing against Jesus Christ is that when you go through the Bible, it seems like the Bible is revealing a God that doesn't waste miracles. And their argument is, if God wanted a home for human beings, why would he make so many useless stars and galaxies? Well, ironically, the rebuttal is in Stephen Hawking's own work. The space-time theorems of general relativity tell us that unless the mass of the universe is very carefully fine-tuned, you get no life at all. So there's a very good reason why we live in a universe with 10 billion trillion observable stars. Only a universe that contains that many stars, no more, no less, would allow for the existence of life. And there's an independent rebuttal to this, namely that if the universe had more mass or less mass, you would get the wrong elements. That the mass of the universe is a catalyst for nuclear fusion. If the universe were even slightly more massive, then the universe would be nothing but elements heavier than iron. And if the universe were even slightly less massive, we would be living in a universe that would have nothing but hydrogen or nothing but hydrogen and helium. Notice that in both kinds of universes, you lack the carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen that's necessary for making life molecules. And we're looking at a fine-tuning that's literally one part in 10 to the 60th. Well, that rebuttal is not used very often anymore, at least not by astronomers and physicists, because enough of us have made the point that, hey, there's a good reason why the universe must be exactly that big. Another rebuttal that dates back a few years was to say, well, of course the universe has all these fine-tuned characteristics. We wouldn't be here to observe the universe unless it had those characteristics. And this was famously rebutted by the British philosopher Richard Swinburne. And Richard Swinburne came up with a word picture. And the word picture was someone being executed by a firing squad. And you can imagine, we could put, say, 12 people here in the front row and give them rifles. And we could take that young lady back there and put her at the podium and have these 12 people aim their rifles at her heart and pull the trigger. And, you know, she survives the event and looks out at all of us and says, well, of course, I wouldn't be here to see all of you unless they all miss. Well, Richard Swinburne's point is this. If you were to survive a firing squad execution, the first thought will be, why did they miss? Not that they miss, but why did they miss? It does not make rational sense that they would miss unless they had purposed that you would survive the execution. So the only rational conclusion to draw is that the people firing the guns purposely missed, or somebody put blanks in their guns, but somebody purposed that they would be alive. Likewise, Swinburne argues that the only rational conclusion for this incredible fine-tuning we observe in the universe is somebody beyond the universe must have a purpose for us being able to live in this universe. Well, probably the most famous rebuttal today, and you'll see this on all the science television shows, it's on BBC, it's on PBS, Discovery, I mean, all around the world, wherever they have science documentaries, you hear this over and over again. Well, the universe has all of these design characteristics because there's an infinite number of universes, and all these universes have different physical characteristics, and we happen to live in the universe that by pure chance has the characteristics necessary for life to exist. Well, as I pointed out in this Creator in the Cosmos, this rebuttal is simply a form of the gambler's fallacy. Now, I'm going to illustrate that for you. What happened to my little coin? Here we go. Okay, I'm a native Canadian, so I got here with me a Canadian nickel. And it has a property that it's got the queen's head on one side, and the other side has got a beaver. Okay? So we flip it. I don't know. Every time I do this, it seems to come up beavers. But what if I were to flip this coin 100,000 consecutive times and it came up beavers all 100,000 times? How many of you would be willing to bet the queen's head on the next flip? Now, you would if you're committing the gambler's fallacy, because you would rationalize as follows. Well, this isn't the only nickel around. If we have enough nickels, and if they're being flipped by enough people, all 100,000 consecutive times each, then one of those flips would produce by pure chance 100,000 consecutive heads. Well, you really do need a lot of coins. You would need 2 to the 100,000 coins being flipped by 2 to the 100,000 people. Now, we all know there are not that many coins in existence. In the case of the universe, we have a more powerful argument. We can only determine the existence of one universe. Moreover, general relativity tells us no matter how much we learn about the universe, we'll never be able to prove that there's more than one universe into existence. Why? General relativity tells us if God made two universes, once you get observers in universe A, the space-time envelope of that universe can never overlap the space-time envelope of any other possibly existing universe. So the sample size for the one referring to this rebuttal is one, and will always be one. And by the way, who says that all the other universes have to have different physical characteristics? That's just an assumption. We don't know. Now, whenever I speak to an audience of astronomers and physicists, I take them through this gambler's fallacy. amazingly, the most common response I get when I take them through this is they say, well, we admit that this is a fallacy. We're not disputing that. But we're going to go along with the fallacy rather than your God, Jesus Christ. I say, well, why would you do that? They say, well, because your God is making very high moral demands in our lives. And because he's making such high demands, we demand extraordinary evidence. I say, well, I did too when I was much younger. I studied the Christian faith for 2 years before I signed my name in the back of a Gideon Bible. And I would invite you to do that kind of study. And, you know, let's go back to the coin analogy. If you saw 100,000 consecutive heads, before you bet heads, wouldn't you like to examine both sides of the coin? I mean, what are there beavers on both sides? Then you could save your money. Well, their response is, you can't do that to the universe. And my rejoinder is, yes, you can. We can do the equivalent of looking at both sides of the coin. How we do that? We simply let astronomical research continue for a few more days. All right? If this is really the gambler's fallacy, then the more we learn about the universe, the more evidence we'll uncover for supernatural design. We'll see the design evidence get stronger. But if this gambler's fallacy has merit, then we expect that evidence to get weaker, and we expect it to get weaker at a very rapid rate. And so what I say to the astronomers is, you know, why don't we just wait a couple of weeks? And if the evidence gets stronger, then you need to seriously consider submitting your life and your moral outlook to the God of the Bible. And by the way, we've had a number of astronomers do exactly just that. We get letters from scientists on a regular basis of their repentance before Jesus Christ, and they're giving their life to Christ. Matter of fact, just a few weeks ago, I heard from a Nobel laureate that he had given his life to Christ after reading three of our books. I don't know how much time I got left. Am I supposed to? About 5 minutes? That's 5 minutes for questions and discussion. But I'm going to give this talk again in the hall across there. So, yeah. Well, repeat the question. The question he's asking is, you know, how do you respond to physicists and astronomers who would claim that their research is revealing through usually quantum gravity cosmic models that you really can get a very large number of universes bubbling out? And this is what the multiverse theory is all about. Well, the truth is, every multiverse publication I've seen, in its simplest form, reduces to a universe, not a multiverse. The multiverse is always an ad hoc extrapolation. And you have to invoke different quantum mechanical laws to get these universes that bubble out, that stick around. You know, it's not that difficult to use the physics to get lots of budding universes. What's really difficult is to get them lasting long enough that they can be of any use for life. I mean, if they return to the space-time quantum foam in 10 to the minus 120 seconds, like the quantum mechanics that we measure today would predict, then this is of no value to their argument. So I'm not quibbling that there's a space-time foam. I'm quite willing to accept that they're right about that space-time foam. But the idea that you can get a universe budding out of that space-time foam that sticks around for 15 billion years and manifests the characteristics that enable life to exist, that will not happen unless you argue for a radical change in the laws of physics. And there's a Bible verse I can give you on this, Jeremiah 33:25. The laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. And this is where I see the great value of string theory, is that with a 10-dimensional creation model, it tells us that the laws of physics remain fixed back to the creation event itself, in which case you close the door on those speculations. And we had Paul Steinhardt talk to us about this some time ago in our Creation Update webcast. We have a lot of scientists that listen to our show. By the way, every week we do a 2-hour webcast. Where we take calls from all over the world, where we talk about the latest scientific discoveries. And in a few of those shows, one of our scientists interviewed Paul Steinhardt, and his comment was, and he's not a Christian, but his comment is, yes, the multiverse is ad hoc. What we're really dealing with is a universe, but we can force the physics by altering the laws of physics to make it a multiverse. But you're violating Occam's razor when you do that. Yes. Right. Right. Yeah, we've made some response. I mean, Parak, for example, has the technique of being highly selective. I'm supposed to repeat the question. Okay, the question was, have we officially responded to any of the published texts that critique intelligent design? And I think I was singled out for a whole chapter in Parak's book. But he quotes from old writings out of context. I noticed that he didn't bother to quote from this at all. And he makes the comment that, quote, I'm out of date. Well, hey, I mean, I wrote my first book in 89. Why don't you read the books I published in 2004? And I notice he did that kind of low-blow criticism against other intelligent design leaders, too. I wasn't the only one where he used that tactic. The other tactic he did was to quote Christians that attack me. Well, I mean, there's lots of Christians that don't agree with me. Just the fact that we Christians disagree doesn't mean we don't have a valid case. So he tries to pit people against one another. But for any encouragement, I notice that Parak's criticisms are not really seriously considered by the leading academics. They look at him, I mean, he's a retired physicist teaching at a four-year college. And, you know, you can just see in his writings that he is coming from a very bitter perspective. So in that sense, I figured it's not worth responding in print. But when the book came out, we did a comment on it on our webcast, literally for the benefit of all the people that were criticized there. Yes. Yes. No, that's correct. He was asking me that Paul Davies, although admitting that there's this overwhelming evidence for design, really is not getting very specific about what's responsible for that design. In fact, he's written a book in your discipline, The Origin of Life, called The Fifth Miracle. And there he's arguing for some hidden law of physics that explains why life comes into existence so suddenly without benefit of a primordial soup. I notice he does the same thing with the universe. He just says there's undiscovered physical laws. Well, my response to that is, how can you keep laws of that magnitude hidden? I mean, they really have this effect of bringing the universe into existence so that it manifests all these qualities of design. We're going to see it. Likewise, if he's referring to some fourth law of thermodynamics that spontaneously creates life, well, that's going to violate the second law. And, you know, where do we see these violations of the second law? And I think one argument that makes it particularly potent, we already know that for life to be possible in the universe must be extremely uniform and homogeneous. That would eliminate the operation of some hidden law of physics in a place of the universe that we haven't seen. For life to even be possible, the physics has got to pervade all the universe. It must be ubiquitous. And as ubiquitous, that law won't be hidden. You're going to find it. So the fact that we don't see that law really means we're looking at something beyond the laws that's responsible for bringing this stuff into existence. I'm going to talk about this when I address the origin of life. Yes. Right. How do you address that sort of purposes, Well, okay, his comment was, aren't there better arguments than the one that Richard Swinburne came up with? And yes, there are. I credited Richard Swinburne because he was the first to develop that kind of philosophical response. This goes back about 15 years. Since that time, others, including Richard himself, have come up with more sophisticated word pictures to bring out the fallacy in the argument. And then you had a second point? I'm not sure I catch your point, in the sense that, you know, the main exposure, the fallacy, is that if this was simply a random event without any thought or planning behind it, given the proximity of the rifles and the good eyesight of the people aiming their guns at the individual's heart, there'd be no possibility, or the possibility would be extremely remote, that an individual could survive that. And that's kind of what Richard Swinburne is saying. Let's come up with an analogy where we have probabilities that are akin to what we're seeing in the fine-tuning. And, you know, these are situations where kind of the man on the street would recognize that the probability is indistinguishable from zero. That's really what Swinburne is trying to get across. If the probability is indistinguishable from zero, then you really don't have any chance. Well, you're looking at it after the event. That does not make the statistical argument invalid. It would only make it invalid if you could show that the physical circumstances in the past were different. But, you know, in astronomy, we can look back in time and prove that the physics was no different back then than it is today. And just because you only got one example doesn't mean... I mean, it's an argument I get frequently on university campuses. I won't believe in creation until I see thousands of repeated creations. Well, you know, give me a break. I mean, if you've got good measurements on that single event, and the probabilities are this extremely low for an alternate explanation, isn't that better than having thousands of repeated instances? So I think the statistics holds. That's the whole point. I mean, if you're going to argue that there's something invalid in the statistics, show me where it's invalid. And for what it's worth, this exposure by Richard Swinburne has been acknowledged by the physics community. And therefore, the physics community is no longer using this as a rebuttal. Okay, maybe one more question. Or okay.